I'm Elena Lang. I live in Zurich. I research in Marx's Critique of Political Economy.
My name is Joshua DePaulis, and I'm currently on the editorial committee of a new Marxist journal.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
I should say at the outset that the reason why I'm having you both on is because someone who is a friend of mine on Facebook and is a follower of yours on Twitter recommended that I check you out and also check out someone called Benedict Cryptofash.
So my friend, okay. a good Twitter friend.
So maybe we should start there. Is there such a thing as the anti-left beyond Twitter? And how seriously should someone take the name Cryptofash when they run across anti-left propaganda online?
Is there such a thing as the anti-left beyond Twitter? Oh dear. But now it depends on what you mean by the anti-left. If you mean a Marxist critique of current leftism, then, I guess our book project proves that there's something beyond happening beyond Twitter. And we have 15 authors for this book criticizing current streams in the left from a Marxist perspective. And this is happening beyond Twitter, definitely. I don't know, but it's not, you know, this is Benedict's moniker, Cryptofash. I think he uses it it's an ironic appropriation of something that he might have been called previously, you know. So you probably have to ask him.
Well, I know I've been called Cryptofash and Red Brown and Strasserite and all sorts of things.
Oh yeah, I know that.
Yeah, but I reject that label, just on the basis of it being
inaccurate. It's just a smear. It doesn't mean anything, you know. These people don't even know who Gregor Strasser was, you know. And if they confronted them with Strasser's writings, they would detect more of their own ilk in that line of thinking than ours.
Why don't I give you guys a chance to introduce yourselves? And maybe I'll put that at the very, very beginning. And I'll get off the stream for a moment and let you to work out introducing yourselves to everyone and like tell people what you want them to know about who you are and what your project is. And Ellen, you can start.
So I'm Elena Lang. I live in Zurich, Switzerland. I'm not Swiss, I'm German, but it doesn't really matter. I teach Japanese intellectual history, modern Japanese intellectual history. I'm a trained philosopher. I have a philosophy PhD, and I just did my habilitation and also a book that is coming out next month in May in a couple of weeks on Uno Kozo, who is a Japanese Marxian economist. And the book is called Value Without Fetish, Uno Kozo's Theory of Pure Capitalism in the Light of Marx's Critique of Political Economy. And that's what I do. I do a research in Marx's Critique of Political Economy.
My name is Joshua DePaulis. I'm an American. I currently live on the Croatian-Hungarian border. Don't ask me why, you know, sometimes things like that just happen. But I first became politically involved more than a decade ago through supporting the activities of politicized prisoners at maximum and super maximum facilities in the state of Virginia in the United States. And on the basis of that activity, I became involved in the formation of a national organizing initiative called the Maoist Communist Group, which still exists. However, I later resigned from that organization due to some fundamental ideological and political differences. And I am currently on the editorial committee of a new Marxist journal of theory and criticism called Counterattack, the first issue of which will be launched in May of this year. And you'll be able to check it out at counterattackjournal.org.
All right. Well, I guess I want to start now with addressing some of the things that were in the essay that you sent me that, you know, you both wrote together. It's called The Middle Class Leviathan, Corona, the Fascism, Blackmail, and the Defeat of the Working Class. But one of the difficulties that you have if you're on YouTube is that certain subjects can't be talked about without triggering the algorithm. So I'm going to couch my first question to you in fictional terms rather than in terms of the lockdowns and the coronavirus. There's an old short story or novella called The Machine Stops by A.M. Forrester. And in that story, written over 100 years ago now, he imagined a future where people mostly stayed in their own underground chambers and communicated via screens. And people didn't go out. They didn't meet in person. They didn't touch. Do you think that a socialist living in that society who wanted to change that society should advocate for the breaking of the machine that made such a life possible? And what if the risk of going out was that people would suffocate or that they wouldn't get enough air because the machine was breaking and the air was too thin? Should socialists be advocating for going out, or would there be another way to try to overcome the society that had trapped people underground? Would they first need to address the problem of a lack of sufficient oxygen in the corridors between the chambers, for instance? So there.
So Douglas, you framed the question in fictional terms, and it's a huge question. But, you know, I think that we're living in a reality that has become more dystopian than fiction itself. So it starts with you telling me about corporate censorship led by algorithms in this very interview we're conducting. Mm-hmm. So how much more dystopian can it get, right? So anyway, so these underground chambers that you described from Ian Forrester's story, they sound quite nice to me, actually, in comparison with the lockdown reality we're facing right now, which is concretely super exploitation of so-called essential workers, children as young as 8 or 9 suffering from anxiety, neurosis, and depression because of lack of social contacts, surge in numbers of suicides of young and elderly people, generalized unemployment, closing down of small businesses, elderly people dying alone, cancer patients treatment being deferred, and so on. I can go on. And all of this in a situation where profits surge. It's been recently known that Daimler met Mercedes-Benz in Germany has saved 700 million euros through short time work to reduce hours contracts because of Corona last year. And all of this while they distributed dividends to their stockholders that are 50% higher than in previous years. And if you look at the profits of Volkswagen as well, we're talking about the real economy now, they had the biggest surge in profit since their founding, since their existence, you know, since they have been founded. So the Corona measures are a gigantic neoliberal restructuring plan. And all of that, and this is what we addressed, Joshua and I, in this text, is all of that is happening with the consent of the left and a strange acquiescence to what I would call really a Corona dictatorship, as there never really was a democratic process to accompany these measures. Part of them are really deep interventions into our civil rights. Now, there's another aspect I wanna close this with. It is a certain kind of debate around Corona, which I call the myth of objective constraint, and the fact that social reality is inverted into a natural fact. The virus is reified as a biological phenomenon, when really it is a social problem. You know, humans who first of all produce the conditions under which this virus emerged, and also the conditions under which it is faced, are at the mercy of this new doctrine, the virus doctrine, Instead of seeing its voluntary character that is mediated by the constraints of capitalism and the monetary form, you know? So just to close this, we don't have enough ICU beds. We don't have enough resources and capacity in hospitals. Mm-hmm. You're telling me this? And just imagine what you could do, what states could do when banks fail, 10 years ago, you know? That was it. And we're confronted with the same challenges, and suddenly it's going to be cutting the demand side from people, you know, who need these services. I don't think this is the right way to go.
Josh, do you want to chime in?
I would add to that. I think, I think, you know, it's an absolutely fundamental principle of Marxism and what I would consider, you know, to be the actual left. I mean, sort of building off your initial question, I think, a better question than whether there's anti-leftism outside of the internet is whether there is an actual revolutionary leftism anywhere right now, at least in the Western world. And I think, you know, a fundamental principle of such a revolutionary leftism, a fundamental principle of Marxism, is that the state is not neutral. It's neutral neither in its form nor in its content. It's not an instrument that anybody can just pick up and use. And it definitely has not been created and formed for the public good. And that's something that, you know, any leftist who uncritically supports the public health policy of this state, which is a class state, it's not a democratic state standing above classes. Any leftist who uncritically supports the public health policy of such a state is committing the same kind of mistake, you know, they would be if they were supporting such a state's security policy or foreign policy or what have you. Like, I think the war against corona needs to be seen in continuity with the war against crime, the war against drugs, the war against terrorism. It's ideologically presented as this service to the public good, but in reality, it's a question of power and it's a question of domination. And in the context of a capitalist society, that means concretely it's a question of the domination of living labor by capital, of extending that domination, and of, in this case, actually more or less preventatively repressing any kind of challenge to it. You know, regardless of what may be the justification.
I just have to say, in an effort to keep this video from being taken down and my channel removed from YouTube, that I fully support the CDC guidelines and the World Health Organization. The lockdown measures are absolutely necessary. And just because these two are being critical of it here doesn't mean that we endorse that view. And I don't want this video to be taken down, please. All right. So having said that, no, I mean, like, really, in fact, I put out a video called The Great Reset, where I was critical of the conspiracy theory about the Great Reset, but also put a few clips up of Alex Jones and others being critical of the lockdown. And it was removed and a warning was put on my channel, on our channel. Saying that if we violate community standards again, our channel would be removed, perhaps permanently. So I want to underline the point that we cannot speak freely about this topic online, regardless of what our views might be. Like, for instance, I actually think I agree with you about reifying the virus, but I think that there's that it's a difficult question as to how to cope with the pandemic once it had been unleashed. Obviously capital and the forces that run society will take advantage of something like this and make hay out of it. You know, they'll do whatever they can to succeed, and they will. And capital concentrates, and the winners are the winners who are already winning. So I don't disagree with a lot of what you're saying. And the real danger right now is that the conditions that were supposed to be emergency conditions during a pandemic will be made semi-permanent.
Yeah.
That's
I agree.
That's the danger. But semi-permanent or permanent. Some things will be made permanent, some things won't. Censorship online will probably become permanent. Mask wearing will be mandated, the ability of the state to step in and lock down for whatever reason will probably become permanent, unless there's resistance to it. And so I agree with you on the, and especially right now, that the culture of criticism around these conditions has to emerge. It just has to. Like, you, if you embrace the idea that after you're vaccinated, you still should mask up, then what are you embracing there? I mean, it's not that I'm against masks, but you're embracing a culture of permanent kind of social isolation and acquiescence to authority.
You know, my mother has a small company and they actually produce masks. So I was testing them for this. This is absolutely, I mean, internet is nuts, but I wanted to say that masks are useful where they're appropriate, you know, but I'm talking about all the other measures, you know, all the restructuring and education and so on, online teaching and so on.
Yeah, online teaching will probably become more dominant.
Exactly.
As well. And it's not working. What I think that we should maybe start to talk about is the difficulty that you might have if you're a Marxist, especially. I'm going to add Josh back to the stream just as soon as he pops back up. We seem to have lost him. Here he is. Okay. All right, you're back, Josh. The difficulty that Marxists might have avoiding being dragged into a culture war, especially because, right, like for instance, right now, culture war tactics are used to justify real policy. And it seems like, you know, so what I want to do is like step around the culture war stuff as much as I can and talk about policy and material conditions and the way capitalism actually functions. But I find that there's a certain kind of, like, first of all, if you talk too much about that, people tune you out. And then also I'll give you an example. And this isn't one of the questions I wrote down, but yesterday I stumbled upon an excerpt, just a line from a Washington Post story that was behind a paywall. So I haven't read it all, but it was about infrastructure spending in the United States.
Oh yeah. I read that too. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were justifying not focusing on physical infrastructure by saying that it had, when you spent money in that direction to rebuild the electrical grid and the roads and the waterways, you were biased or had a nostalgia for the working class white male.
It is unbelievable. This is unbelievable.
I know. And
there's, I mean,
so how can you ignore that, right? I mean, like, how can you ignore that kind of move to justify not rebuilding the roads in the name of overcoming, I guess, white supremacy or class reductionism?
Building infrastructure is white supremacy, you know? This is
right. I mean, it's just side of thing that. Yeah, but the other thing they did say, and if you look deeper into it, it doesn't get a lot better, is that you have to invest also in the care infrastructure, which would mean investing in a whole. It seems to me on the surface, when I looked into it a little bit, that it's a matter of funding a lot of NGOs.
So yeah, I mean, this what impresses me about this accusation of you know, you're gonna sound like a Republican or you're gonna sound like a conservative is that it's a projection. You know, it's the reactionary position actually comes from people who tell you to check your privilege and companies who demand land acknowledgement. Oh dear, I didn't think it was a real thing, but then this friend of mine on Twitter told me that it's actually a real thing, land acknowledgement. So companies who demand that sort of thing from the employees while they're exploiting the labor. So this argument is really stunning because the Marxist stream, I think I represent, would precisely say that current leftism is so strikingly anti-materialist. Leftism is the force that aligns itself to conservative and sometimes even racist discourse. This is what's happening right now. So you can't read a piece of leftist, I would say, critique or theory, you know, high academic theory, without being reminded how, and I quote, racially heterogeneous the working class supposedly is. So you wonder, am I reading, you know, I don't know, Nikhil Pal Singh or Charlie Post or 19th century race hygienist? You know, this is always this invocation of race, which is devoid. You know, you can't talk about it in a critical way as Barbara and Karen Fields did in Racecraft. which is the way to talk about race, and also Oliver Cromwell Cox, now off the top of my head. This is the way to talk about it. But these new leftist academics, these trained leftist professional, these radical tenured professionals, that it's devoid of an understanding of capitalism and especially the capital relation, the relation between capital and labor, and exhausts its critique and moral posturing for minorities, which never change anything about the lives of the people they are so worried about. And, you know, so I think this whole accusation of, oh, you're going to be reactionary is a projection of their own position onto their, you know, their supposed adversaries.
Well, I think that's somewhat true, but I've also witnessed people on the left start to become very concerned about the very problems you're speaking of, and they're real problems, but then end up focusing so exclusively on that, that they end up becoming an outright claiming to be reactionaries after a while, or
yeah, because people get exhausted. And it's not good. It's not good that they get this, because the materialist critique, the historical analysis, our historical materialist analysis would show that you cannot replace exploitation for a vague notion of oppression or discrimination. And it's a theoretical problem we're facing here. It's a theoretical dichotomy, if you will. And they are not the same. And what happened, I think, and we talk about this in the Conformist Rebellion, the book that Joshua and I are editing together, which is out next January, early 22, is that exploitation is historically specific to capitalism. It's the law of value, which takes on an impersonal form of domination, and it gets conflated in these new leftist theories, that texts that I've been reading for the last 10 to 15 years. It gets conflated with discrimination and forms of oppression, and oppression and exploitation, they are not the same thing. You know, and if you make it very clear why capitalism is a historical specific form of production, even, you know, where social relations assume an entirely new form, then I don't think that you can. This is a historical materialist critique, and how will you get from that position to saying, oh, this is reactionary, how could this happen? You know, there's no criteria. There have to be criteria from conservatism in this kind of analysis that I don't see reflected. Maybe sometimes, as you say, people would say, oh yeah, okay, calling myself conservative or reactionary, because they're tired. You know, some of us have gotten tired with all this happening. So, but yeah. I don't think it's the way. You know, I still call myself a Marxist, and now I am, because I work on
right,
Marx.
Right, right. not to belabor the point, but I just know that when you're operating within the political realm, there are material or there's basically people with money who will fund your projects, and certain kinds of messages will get money from certain sectors, and other kinds of messages will get money from other sectors. You can look at a publication like Spiked, which was at one time a very critical of the left in some ways that were, I think, justified, but over time have become a basically right-wing libertarian publication and have received funds in that from which is not like a crime, okay? It's not a crime for people to be capitalist libertarians, and but I'm just saying they're not Marxist anymore, and they had this path towards this different kind of analysis and basically a return to bourgeois perspective. And the other thing I'll say is that when the left is as regressed as it is, and so and as misguided as it is, sometimes just regular old classical liberalism looks better in comparison. I find that I can stand listening to centrist left, real centrists, like self-avowed centrists, more easily than I can listening to other leftists a good portion of the time, because they can speak more honestly. And you know what their limits are, you know, in their thinking, and you can see it.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about Spike sure. I don't know how Marxist they are. They certainly don't have a critique of political economy. That's what you say, because they have taken up so many culture war issues. But do they really claim to be that Marxist? I don't know. I mean, I would rather take, you know, I would rather look at some radical Marxist publications, especially in the academic field, and hold them to their own standards about their Marxism. You know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When I hear something, I just wrote a new piece for my Substack. My Substack's called Laurier's Feet. A feast, beetroot, and music, as Marx called the Trinity formula of Adam Smith. It's, you know, it's a long story. But anyway, so I just wrote a piece on an article from Brooklyn Rail. Mm-hmm. Brooklyn Rail publishes a lot of
radical liberal stuff. And, yeah,
not so good stuff. And I was reading this text. I was reading this text by Charlie Post on so-called racial capitalism, and these arguments are bizarre. And he contradicts himself with every second sentence, and he makes these tautological claims. And I would rather hold these people, you know, who claim themselves, you know, as the avant-garde of Marxist progressivism. You know, I'd take up their claims and ask them, are you really that well versed in Marxist theory? If you make that
right.
claim?
Yeah, no, this is a big problem on the Marxist left, is that Marx becomes like a ventriloquist dummy for whatever exactly. ideology people want to take on. And then if you criticize someone for using the term racialized capitalism, they'll accuse you of denying the long history of real racism, yeah. you know, so I know what the problem is, and there is a big hindrance there to just getting people to think deeply about the system that's actually functioning and what it's doing to us. I am just always trying to, thread the needle just right, you know, avoid taking on an ascetic of the right while I can continue to critique the left. And I guess that's
But do you realize how narrow the political horizon has become, that Marxists were actually quote borrowed long passages from Capital and the Grundrisse and the theories of surplus value. They are called reactionaries or fascists or racists. What is going on? I mean, what is the political spectrum? What has it come to? And people should reflect that. You know, it's not really about individuals being called names. I don't care about that. Mm-hmm. I care about what are the options? Why has it become so narrow? Why has it become so heated? And why has it become so vain and narcissistic?
Let's talk a little bit about the theory in your, and I'm sorry we lost Josh, but in your essay, The Middle Class Leviathan, answer the question of why this is happening. And this is where we might have more fundamental disagreements. So far, we really just have been, I've basically been making excuses for not being a little bit more strident about these issues than I am, maybe, about the way the left has been constrained. But when we look for an explanation as to why, I'm not sure it's as clear as you make it out to be in your essay. Like, for instance, blaming the way the left has become PMC, to me, overlooks some of the problems that are more longstanding around how to organize the proletariat. What we can expect from the proletariat.
Doc, I'm sorry to say, but this was also in this interesting trailer you made where you put me alongside Glenn Greenwald. This is not the claim we're making, you know, in the paper. We don't say, oh, you know, they are PMC and that's why it's something bad. We're not, you know, I'm PMC, hell's sake, you know, and Marx and Engels were fucking PMC, you know. It's like, right. that's not what's going on. It's a bit more complicated. So first of all, what's the definition of the professional managerial class? I would say it's a class of intellectual laborers whose job it is to produce the ideological superstructure. This is they are these mental laborers. And as such, they are also at the mercy of capital. You know, while they themselves, and this is interesting, and this is where the critique of the PMC comes in, they present their own class interests as the interests of the oppressed. You know, and this is where they get the leverage from, you know, this moral imposition, this moral gesturing, moral posturing. But I would also say, and Josh can add something to that, because it's the point he makes in the paper, they don't really have a political project of their own. You know, so what should that project be? You know, they, in this historical moment, they are simping for the neoliberal project because it secures them a living. But it may very well look differently. You know, they are, you can say they are the sycophants of the system right now. And it's not because of the class position per se. You know, they can shift, that can shift. But it's because that's the easiest way they can secure a living in a very precarious time of austerity in all sectors, you know, of labor. You obviously need the analysis, the historical analysis of what has happened in the last, I would say, maybe 50 years, certainly since the emergence of neoliberal politics, you know, and as we know, neoliberal politics emerged in the 1950s already, and it was implemented only in the late 1970s. But this is something that happened that has constantly, I would say, atomized the individuals of the society, and has developed its own tactics to use divisive scheme to divide the working class. And this has been happening on many different levels. But what's happening now is a qualitative change. It has something that's because what I said before about what is going on. Are you either you're a progressive or a fascist? What are these two options, you know? And that's why we talk about the fascism blackmail, because there is no politics proper anymore. We don't have politics proper anymore because politicians do not longer talk about politics. They look at their popularity rates, and they I have a certain politician in mind, a female politician, a Democratic Party congresswoman, popularity rates, and they do these little TikTok internet appearances, and it's commodification of politics into something that I would call a bad moral philosophy. You know, and that's why the fascism blackmail that we talk about works so well, because if you are a worker and you want to fight, say, these corona measures, the COVID measures, and you want to stand up and organize and strike, you are labeled as somebody who wants people to die. You know, there's this extreme moral urge to blackmail these people, or you're labeled a fascist, right? Yeah. And there's no news cycle, say on German TV, that you can't hear that the people are, you know, many protesters on the streets against the measures, and they never fail to add that there are so many Nazis among these people, which may be true, but this is a certain kind of propaganda, it's a certain kind of tactic. So people, if you join these people who protest on the street, who protest these measures, which are detrimental to the interests of the working class, then you're a fascist. This is what's happening. And this is the new quality, I think, to stifling resistance of workers that has been going on
What do you make of the fact that the people who call themselves fascists and or Nazis and in America, the alt-right, have actually been capturing class issues and where, while the left has sort of dropped them, mm-hmm. even Marxists don't want to talk about racial issues before they talk about class now. But what do you make of the fact that these forces are emerging, and how do we, you know, I mean, on the one hand, I don't think the fascist threat or the Nazi threat is fully real. I think it's a paper tiger to a large extent. But I also think that could change. That I can't see into the future. And what looks like a paper tiger now may turn into something else later. And the riots at the Capitol building, it's hard to exactly interpret what they signified, but they certainly did justify some of the more extreme rhetoric around Trump. So, you know, to me, I feel like we do have the responsibility to distinguish ourselves as strongly as we can from the people who are trying to steal the class analysis from what remains of the left. And like people like Tucker Carlson in America or certainly Steve Bannon in America, that we can't actually let them define what class politics are. So.
Yeah, but this is exactly what I'm doing, Douglas. I mean, this is my political work, and that's why it's so ironic, you know, when people... I haven't been called these names recently, not that I know.
I'm not calling you these things. I know that you're not,
but some people may when they know I'm criticizing the left as it is at the moment. Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm saying, Steve Bannon, come on. I mean, I don't think he has such attraction. And Tucker Carlson is an interesting phenomenon because he looks like this student of economics from the early 80s. I can't really take him seriously. Although I have to say, I sometimes watch his show. And have you seen this interview? Speaking of the Capitol riots, have you seen the interview with Ariel Pink?
No, I haven't seen
it. So Tucker Carlson has interviewed Ariel Pink, who is this great musician. He's been dropped from his label because he attended the protests. Not the riots. He went there to, as he said, see his president. I never expected that from Ariel Pink. You know, he has this pink hair and, you know, he's this crazy guitarist and so on. And seeing these people together, and I was asking myself, oh my God, I'd never think I'd live to see the day when somebody, you know, who looks like a FDP a voter, you know, the German Liberal Party and Ariel Pink in this room together and having this conversation. There's a clash of, I would say that's a real clash of civilizations happening here. So what's happening is Tucker Carlson really appropriating leftist culture for his own ends. I think he has some valid points, but I also think that, I mean, he's a Fox News host. You know, I'm not sure whether big resistance will come from that, from the views of that channel. And, you know.
Right. So like when someone like Glenn Greenwald goes on Tucker Carlson, my perspective is Glenn Greenwald is not struggling for socialism. He has a fragmented political perspective where he takes on issue by issue and he tries to champion the causes that he champions and report on the issues that he's investigating. And he goes on whatever outlet will have him on. And I don't begrudge him that. When someone who says that they're a socialist goes on Tucker Carlson, then a whole different set of criteria arises in my mind because I say, okay, who are they trying to organize? What is their vision of socialism?
Yeah.
Who are they trying to alienate? You know, so because then now that's to me part of a political project. The problem is I'm wrong. There's no political project for socialism right now. There is no party. There is no discipline. There's only kind of a cultural aesthetic and some unwritten norms. But so go ahead.
So, yeah, that's what we're saying in our essay in the Middle Class Leviathan as well. I'm a little bit hesitant to use the qualifier socialist for the politics that I represent, but I think this is an American thing, and I'm here in Europe, and being a reader of an ardent reader of Marx and having written a 600-page tome on Marx. Marx was really very critical of socialism, you know. So if you say, well, we need to organize the socialist vanguard party, even then. You know, I don't know. To Marx, socialism was a bourgeois ideology, and
right. But he was a communist. But he also used those terms like interchangeably in the Critique of the Gotha Program. I don't really feel like socialism and communism can be distinguished when you take it from a Marxist perspective. that, yeah, he was a critique of all the other socialists, but he was also a part of the socialist movement. He was not anti-socialist. He was just like, okay, look, you're still...
He was anti-socialist. If you read his critique of socialists like Proudhon or Bruno Bauer and all these people, and that is because socialists, like socialists, most socialists, maybe not you, it's a question of definition, socialists today are very, they're very concerned about inequality, you know, and mm-hmm. This is not a communist topic. Inequality is not a communist theme. The social form of production is a communist theme, because communists, they want to, you know, they want to overthrow the existing social form of production and to supersede the contradiction between capital and labor. And this is not what socialists want to do. But okay, as I said, that's maybe a very American thing. But when I hit,
well, I mean, the other thing historically, we can call them all social democrats.
I don't have anything to do with it.
Go ahead. I just historically in the 19th century, we could have also referred to Marx as a member of a social supporter of a social democratic party. I mean, now all these terms change their meaning depending on mm-hmm. and as Marx critiques people, he's an anti-socialist when he's talking about Proudhon, and he's for socialism when he's expounding on his on the need to overthrow the commodity form. You know, it's like, yes. But if you're asking me, like, am I a democratic socialist of the Bernie Sanders tradition? No, absolutely not. But if you, you know, if you want to ask me, are you a communist? I'll say, sure, but not mm-hmm, of the mm-hmm. Stalinist type. You know, it's like, so.
No, but then you would be a Stalinist, you know, then you wouldn't be a communist. Okay, right. But this is just definitions. But I want to, because I know some of my anti-left friends or mutuals on Twitter, they would also reject the term socialism, but they would embrace the term communism. You know, but this is a question. This is a different angle from which to view capitalism. You know, the question always is, you cannot define a political position unless you understand what you're critiquing, what the object of critique is, you know. And capitalism has nothing to do with the hoarding of riches in the hands of the few. This is not the concept of capital, you know. Capital is a social relation.
No, it involves hoarding and circulation, and it's not about necessarily even always the private accumulation of capital. There can be mm-hmm. state capital from my perspective. And So you know, listen, we've been talking for 49 minutes, almost 50. What I want to do is give Josh a chance to try to reconnect. Maybe he's been in the background. Maybe his internet's working better. We'll try to all get back together in about 10 minutes and do a second round for patrons only. And in the parent room, this is what I call the patron only. This is where we make some money on this. We just talk a lot of gossip, and our most anti-left content is for our core patron audience, where we talk shit about other leftists. But if people are watching this, if they want to watch me really get taken apart or take you apart, then we can they can tune into the Parrot Room. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.